The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we will call a tax committee to order when we have a quorum. I think we'll just go right down in order here of the bills today, since 2314 is the only one where there's a member of the tax committee. So we'll just start at the top with Representative Franzen. Like I said, we'll go to Rosenthal's bill. Okay, I will move when we have a quorum, House File 2876. And then, are there amendments, Representative Rosenthal, to your bill?
Mr. Chair, members, yes.
Just the A1 amendment? And, Representative, is that yours, or is there another one? And there's an A2, members. It should be on a pile. I don't know if it's been put in the bill jacket. So is the A2 also yours?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. When we have a quorum, we'll quickly get the bill in the shape you would like, and then we'll work on it from there. So if you could please present the bill as if both amendments were added, Representative Rosenthal.
Sure.
Please present your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2876 is a result of meeting small businesses around the state and hearing their concerns, whether it be a single business or a group of business like the Independent Business Association. One of the primary concerns that was voiced is that compliance with tax laws and the audit process can be overly complicated and expensive for small businesses. This bill is aimed at reducing time and money small business owners pay for audits, and it's a starting point on streamlining and simplifying the process. Mr. Chair, I can go through sections of the bill, or I could have testifiers, whichever you
Why
prefer.
Why don't we, would Ms. Manzi or Mr. Mike like to just kind of go through some highlights? Is that okay, Representative Rosenthal?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Michael?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill has essentially four provisions. Section one of it establishes a private letter ruling program that's very similar to what the IRS has, and that essentially allows taxpayers to apply to the Department of Revenue for a ruling that would essentially give them certainty as to the taxation of a transaction or a situation that the taxpayer has that they could rely on, but that would not be precedent for some other taxpayers. Section 2 imposes limits on the commissioner's assessment authority in instances where the commissioner has approved in writing the taxation of the taxpayer's situation in a prior audit or something like that, if the commissioner has not notified the taxpayer of a change in the department's position. Section 3 gives the commissioner authority, wider authority, to abate penalties. And Section 4 imposes a de minimis rule on penalties that says that if the percentage calculation of a penalty would be less than $150, it would not apply. So basically it's a minimum of $150 for the penalty.
Thank you.
And Section 5 is an appropriation to cover the cost of the private letter ruling program.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Representative Rosenthal?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Michael gave a very good overview of the bill.
Does anybody want to question Mr. Michael's presentation of the bill? Good job, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so you have a couple folks who would like to testify on behalf of the bill, and then I believe the department would like to be a resource on the bill. And then is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of or with concerns thereof? On House, members were on House File 2876, the Rosenthal bill. Okay, I think we know what we're doing here. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Busacher. I'm a director with the Grant Thornton, an accounting firm in Minneapolis. I'm here today speaking for myself. I'm not representing the firm or any particular client. I wanted to focus, first of all, on Section 2, And I wanted to talk about sales tax under Section 2. Remember that the taxpayers, the vendors, are uncompensated collection agents on behalf of the state. They're trying to do the best job that they can to make the determinations as to what's taxable and what's exempt and what they should be collecting tax on. The fact pattern that I've seen and that really troubles people is when they've been audited in the past for sales tax purposes, and the department has perhaps made some adjustments and they've made the corrections. And then later on, there's another audit by the department, and lo and behold, an issue comes up that had not been addressed before. And the auditor assesses tax going back several years, and the taxpayer has been trying to do their best. They thought they had everything cleaned up because they've been audited before, and now they've assessed additional sales tax, and they're saying, look, I can't go back and bill my customers for that. They won't pay it. So let's do what's fair. Let's do what's equitable. I will change my tax collection method going forward if you abate this assessment. And the response that I get from the auditors and from appeals is, we're sorry, but we can't do that. Why can't you do that? Well, we believe it's taxable. And these are very gray areas. If they were black and white, the taxpayer would have done it, or prior auditors would have picked it up. And so what this bill does is to say in that situation, the department is to abate the assessment and the taxpayers to change their collection methods going forward. That seems to be the fair, equitable method to handle this situation where the taxpayer is doing what they thought was right and they've been audited in the past. Now, this does not apply if they've not been audited. This is where they've been audited in the past and they thought they were doing everything right. Now, I understand talking this morning that the department is interested in trying to change some of these methods going forward, and I certainly hope so, and I welcome and look forward to the opportunity to work with the department on that. But this is an issue that really upsets taxpayers when they feel they've been doing it, they've been doing their best and they've been audited before, and then all of a sudden an issue comes out of the blue that nobody had seen before. And this seems like a fair and equitable method to handle that. I'd also like to testify on Section 1, the private letter ruling issue, that I understand and appreciate the fact that the department has been issuing fact sheets and has been holding seminars, and that it's time-consuming for the department to do rules. Some 25 years ago, you as legislators gave the department the authority to issue revenue notices so that people would be on notice as to what the department's issue is on difficult tax matters. Over the last couple years, the number of revenue notices has gone down dramatically. There's only a couple a year. This proposal solves a lot of issues. That there are complex issues out there that we as practitioners need to be able to engage the department with and to secure the department's views on items before taxpayers enter into transactions or how they conduct their business. This allows taxpayers for a fee to work with the department. But very importantly, it also gives the department funding so that the department can be responsive to our needs on a going forward basis. And so that's why I speak in favor of not only the funding for the department, but also the private letter ruling, so that we can work with the department prior to an audit and help taxpayers do it right before they get audited. That's my testimony, and I'd be willing to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Busacker. I will officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. As we have a quorum, I will move House File 2876. And members, you should have an A1 amendment. That is an author's amendment. I'll move the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. I will now move the H2876A2 amendment, also an author's amendment. Representative Rosenthal?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. So now we have the bill in the shape the author would like and the shape that we've been discussing it in. Are there any questions for Mr. Busacker? Chair Anderson.
Mr. Busacker.
Okay. We'll go for the author. First of all, are there any questions for Mr. Busacker? Thank you for your testimony, sir. Questions for the author at this point, Chair Anderson?
More a question for you, Mr. Chair.
Ooh, that can wait. Chair Anderson, your question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I apologize for arriving late. I didn't hear where you plan on sending it. I do see that this is creating a program for the Commissioner of Revenue to do. Obviously, I don't know if there's a fiscal note that's been requested on this, but this would come under the state government finance purview.
Chair Anderson, we weren't going to send it anywhere at this point, but you, if it gets goes further, then I would think we'd need to have that discussion and get it so it's had all its proper hearings.
Mr. Chair, a fiscal note has been requested and should come in sometime this week.
That's been delivered.
What's been requested? Oh, the fiscal note. Yeah. Oh, okay.
We have it here.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, for that, and we'll want to make sure it's all done correctly. Okay, if you would please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
My name is Todd Mickelson, and I am a small business owner. I own a very small business that sells, the name of the business is the RM Group, and we sell equipment I've developed for the industry of architectural testing. We sell to countries all over the world, but we're still a very small business. My wife and I run it together. And while large corporations may have their own accounting department to deal with things like audits, us small businesses are often forced to deal with it ourselves. And if a mistake has been made, it's not on purpose. And the mistake was made because doing taxes is pretty complicated for small business owners. It seems to me that when someone makes an honest mistake, having a possibility of waiving the penalty should be considered. The time it takes to deal with taxes for small businesses is already a difficult thing. Then having to deal with preparing for an audit is stressful and more time-consuming, and having to pay a penalty on top of that for making an honest mistake just doesn't seem right. So the reconsideration of whether or not to penalize us small businesses that this bill provides and has been explained very, very well by the previous testifier would be of great help, and it would be an encouraging gesture for the state to make toward us truly small businesses. Also, the private letter, it would be obviously very helpful for us to get some guidance and assistance on how to prepare for the audit before the audit occurs. So helping simplify the audit process to reduce the amount of time, money, and stress for us to go through this costly process seems to me to be a no-brainer. And I'm speaking as an independent small business owner, and I'm also speaking for the membership of the Metro Independent Business Alliance and Main Street Alliance. They and the rest of us truly small business owners who make up more than 95% of Minnesota's businesses would very much appreciate these things, so we're all really pulling for this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mickelson. Any questions for Mr. Mickelson? Chair Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, for either of the witnesses, I'm curious, what kind of a timeline is given when they're going to do an audit? I would assume if you're a small business, you need a little lead time to prepare for it. And
you probably know the
if
answer.
You get a letter from Mr. the department Boothacker. That there's going to be an audit, do they give you a reasonable amount of time, or how does that work?
Mr. Busacker? Or Mr. Mickelson?
Yeah.
Mr. Busacker.
Yes, no, there's a reasonable amount of time, and the department would work to grant extensions if you need additional time. So, yeah.
Okay. Chair Carlson?
I was just curious as to what the timeline would be if there was...
Mr. Chair, could I add one?
Thank you. Mr. Mickelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think even with the adequate amount of time, the private letter that would help with more information on guidance for small businesses on how to prepare for the audit would be extremely helpful. The amount of time doesn't matter all that much if we don't know what we're doing to begin with. So I think the assistance from the private letter would be very helpful. Thank you.
Chair Carlson.
Yeah, that would be helpful. Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Busacker or Mr. Mickelson? Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. Now I believe that the department would like to be a resource on this bill. Two resources. Whoa. Tag team. Welcome the committee assistant commissioner Cummings. And I'm just looking in the future. I'm sorry. Please state your name if you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal, and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I was able to connect with Representative Rosenthal before the hearing and throughout this session, and he has been very open to hearing our comments, which has been very appreciated. So thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Mr. Chair, before we comment specifically on the bill, I wanted to provide some background for members about some of the policies that have impacted how we relate to our customers. Ms. Starr will talk about our current feedback we are receiving on audits, outreach, and education efforts. Then I will provide some specific feedback on the bill itself. In 2013, Mr. Chair, citing a need for additional resources, the legislature directed the Commissioner of Revenue to hire more auditors and collectors. These were efforts to increase compliance. They were generally called compliance initiatives. During every budget cycle up until 2013, the legislature enacted new compliance initiatives, placing a new initiative on top of the last initiative. Each new initiative dollar meant an increased number of audits were required to generate the revenue, and new collection actions were pursued. When no new compliance initiative was enacted in 2013, we continue to audit those furthest from compliance, and we are able to expand outreach, education, and coaching, which Ms. Starr will talk more about.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Starr, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Business Taxes at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'm hoping that a slideshow might appear on the screen, and I think I'm close on the technology, but not quite.
Welcome to the committee.
But while we work on that, I'm just going to get started. First of all, I just want to remind folks that the mission of the Department of Revenue is working together to fund Minnesota's future. Our vision is that everyone reports, pays, and receives the right amount, no more, no less. Our mission and vision guide the entire Department of Revenue, and although this presentation is focused specifically on our sales and use tax division, it's an example of how we live up to that mission and vision throughout the department. I do have handouts, so maybe we'll get those going instead and people can follow along. My remarks today are grouped into three topics. The first is improving our audit quality. The second is to focus on how we communicate with our customers. I hope the slideshow's working by then, because I'd like to show you our website. And I'll share some information about our educational efforts. If you follow along on the handouts, I'm going to start with the one with a blue banner across the top. The first thing I want you to know is that we started in our sales and use tax division a quality review team in 2013. And this is to help ensure that all of our sales tax audits are professional, accurate, and timely. The quality review team reviews audits for consistency, accuracy, and fairness. And the team also conducts post-audit surveys to measure our success and find areas for further improvement. So we send a survey out to everyone that we've had an audit relationship with who has an email address on file with the Department of Revenue. We look at the results on a quarterly basis, and anyone who asks for a follow-up call, who has a specific question or concern, we follow up. And our survey results are incredibly positive, so I just want to share a few with you. For example, 92% of those who completed our survey indicated that our auditors communicated well. We kept them informed during the audit of the audit process, and we were available to answer their questions as questions arose. 89% agreed that our auditors provided quality education about our sales tax laws and how to stay in compliance with those laws. And 93% indicated that our auditors used their time in our offices wisely. And for me, this is important because one thing we hear, especially from small businesses, is that our interruption in their day-to-day business with an audit it is a disruption. And so to the extent that we minimize the amount of time in people's places of business and that we're doing that well is an important indicator of strong customer service. Also, 95% of our auditors tell us that we treated them fairly during the audit, which is also an important part of quality customer service. If you're following along, the statistics I was reading from are under survey responses are positive on the first page of the blue banner. We also receive a number of very positive notes for our customers. Oh, but that's where I have my notes. Okay, they'll just have to skip
it. We'll take a short break.
These are my notes. No, this is keep going. It's okay.
All right.
Okay, it's okay. The PowerPoint, though, by the way, is really beautiful. So you're missing out.
And there's so much work.
And they are a lot of work.
Ms. Starr, could you please forward emails of the PowerPoints to members so we can see its beauty?
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. Can we get that off? So at the bottom of that first handout with the blue banner, you'll see a lot of positive feedback that we get on that survey. So people who say our auditors are educated well and know their stuff, they're very helpful and approachable and responsive. I want to tell you just a little personal story. So every year in December, I go to Ingebrigtsen's, which is a Norwegian market on Lake Street in Minneapolis. Oh, yes. I've been going there since I was a kid. I get there early with my coffee and my hat on, and I stand in line because we must have our Norwegian meatballs and our ribs and the cheese with caraway seed in it cannot be missed. And when I was standing in line this year, you know, whoever your next two chats with you, how long have you been doing this? Do you speak Norwegian? These are the questions we ask one another. I'm always asked, what do I do for a living? And I'm very proud and have always been very proud to speak about my public service at the Department of Revenue. This year, the person standing next to me in line asked me if I had anything to do with sales and use tax. I was initially concerned what was about to happen. And then he told me that he runs a hardware store in the area and that he was recently audited by the Department of Revenue and that he had a wonderful experience. Those were his words. He said that our auditor was dressed well. That was the first thing he noticed. That we were timely, that we were clear in communicating the issues we would be looking at, that we limited the documents we needed to only the things we really needed, that we minimized our time and disruption in his place of work. And at the end of the day, while we did find some additional tax that was needed on the sales tax side, we found some refunds that were appropriate on the use tax side. And at the end of the day, he reported that he thought the process was fair and reasonable, and that we should be proud of our staff, which I am. We've made a number of other audit quality improvements as a result of our audit quality team, and you'll see some on the back page of that first handout with the blue banner. For example, we've trained all of our auditors on a concept we call materiality. We use this to try and avoid unproductive audit time and eliminate immaterial assessments. If we find smaller issues that are not material during an audit, we'll offer a customer targeted education to help that customer move into compliance going forward. We also use data analytics for those customers. We use data analytics for a couple of purposes. One, to identify customers who are furthest from compliance, but also issues that are furthest from compliance. And we also use those analytics to ensure a balanced audit process across all industries. And the other thing that's been a big deal here in the last couple of years is we've really improved the electronic file sharing that we can offer to our customers. So we have two programs now. One's called Move It. One is called our Electronic Audit Room. And what these allow our customers to do is provide large amounts of their documents over electronic file exchange 24 hours a day. So they can send us their documents when it's most convenient for them, and our auditors can review those during our normal business hours. Now, this is the part of the presentation that I can't show you. I wanted to show you our robust website, but I'll just give you a few highlights. So part of what's important with us about communicating with our customers is that we provide as much broad-based education for as many of our customers as possible, and that we make it available in as many formats as possible. So all folks who have different kind of learning styles can find the information that they need, and that they can find it at a time when it's most convenient for them. So if you're following along with those handouts, I think I am now moving to the orange. I'm at the bottom of the second page of the blue banner, and soon to move to that orange banner page. So on the website, you'll find things like numerous fact sheets. In this past year, we've updated 37 of these into plain language, and we've created new fact sheets, often at the request of our customers. The last one was at the request of our nonprofit customers, and we published that fact sheet in collaboration with the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We've also added what we call industry guides. So if you ever play around on our website, you're going to see a whole new thing called an industry guide. What we're trying to do here is find a way to gather all the kinds of information that a particular industry might be interested in, all in one place. So if you're looking for fact sheets, statutes, rules, revenue notices that are all applicable to your industry, we're hoping to gather those all in one place so it's easier for you to find the information you need. The other big improvement on our website this year is as a result of a lot of feedback that we heard last legislative session about our sales tax rate calculator. So if you relied on our rate calculator online, you had to know the 9-digit zip code of the place where you were making your sale, which was hard on folks. Lots of folks don't know their 9-digit zip code. So you'd have to go out to the United States Postal Service website to obtain that zip code and then come back to our website. Well, we fixed that. All you need is the street address in the state, Minnesota, and our system will now identify that 9-digit zip code for you. Our sales and use tax division alone over the past year has responded to almost 12,000 emails. We respond to those within 2 to 3 business days. And about half of those are substantive law questions. And this is a way in which we're trying to make sure that small businesses get answers to their question in the most efficient, least costly way possible. We've also answered almost 60,000 telephone calls in our sales and use tax division alone. And this year, we mailed 713 educational letters to particular industries that had particular questions they wanted answered. Okay, now I'm moving on to the orange banner page. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about our outreach through education. So in fiscal year 2015 alone, the Sales and Use Tax Division offered 319 hours of free education in sales and use tax, serving more than 3,500 customers. And this year, for the first time, we added monthly webinars so that our customers could access our most popular course, our basic sales and use tax course, from the comfort of their own computers. The first couple of these monthly webinars that we put up, registration filled up in less than 10 minutes, so we know that this is an offering that people wanted. We also offer an educational speakers bureau, which just means that industries can come forward and let us know that as a group they have a particular area of need of education, and we will gather up our training resources and provide targeted education to those groups. And we do this work throughout the state of Minnesota. So when you receive the PowerPoint over email, you're going to see a picture of the state of Minnesota and notice that these courses are offered throughout the state. New venues for 2015 included Detroit Lakes, Wilmer, and Moorhead. Other recently added venues included Grand Rapids and Owatonna. And just for historical context, for the amount of change that we have experienced over time here with these educational courses, in 2007, the Sales and Use Tax Division offered 19 classes. In calendar year 2015, we offered 110. So there has been a significant increase in trying to make sure that broad-based education is reaching as many of our customers as possible. In closing, what I want you to know is that we have been focused over the past few years specifically on listening to what our customers want.
And overwhelmingly what we hear is that impacts should impact their day-to-day business operations as little as possible, and that they need as timely and efficient answers to their questions as possible. Our focus on audit quality, outreach, and education in our sales and use tax division is an example of delivering just that. And again, it's just an example of the quality work that is going on throughout the entire department. I appreciate being here today, and I'll turn it back over to Paul.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Starr. You make it sound like having audit is fun. I'll just leave it at that. Thank you. Very, very good presentation. Before we go back to Mr. Cummings, we will go for some questions here. But before we even do that, is there anyone on the Franzen, Johnson, or David's bill that has traveled more than 50 miles? Okay, we'll make sure that we get you on here.
And Mr. Chair?
Mr. Cummings.
I did want to note we do have comments on the bill, and we do thank the committee for the time today to comment both about what's going on at the department and on the bill. We haven't commented yet on the bill.
Oh, you will certainly have time to do that. Chair Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just perhaps a question for the Assistant Commissioner. Thank you for your presentation, and I want to really commend the department for their effort to do more outreach, especially to the businesses that may be subject to audit and understanding of the sales and use tax and that. But just a question, I mean, do you hire an outside firm to do sort of the follow-up survey of businesses and that? I suspect many of the members here occasionally get complaints from businesses who said, you know, I had an auditor in my business for 3 weeks disrupting activity, and they ended up finding like less than $20 discrepancy in sales and use tax. How much did the department spend on sending the auditor there for 3 weeks? How much less business did I spend? And I've just heard a lot of frustration. So I'm wondering how free businesses would be to complain directly to the Department of Revenue if they were unhappy, knowing that, you know, just, you know, maybe maybe there would be some something that would occur if they were to be very vocal with you about unhappy they were about their audit process.
Assistant Commissioner Starr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so I too receive those concerns now and again, but I want you to know that the prevalence of that concern is much less over the past few years than it was when we were working under compliance initiatives. But even so, if that happens, we want to know about it. So one of the first things that we do today in our business taxes is we make sure that a supervisor's name and telephone number is on every letter that starts the audit process, so that our customers know immediately who they can make that first point of contact with. But also, my name and contact information is on our website, and I am happy to directly take those calls. And like everyone at Revenue, we are responsible for hearing feedback and engaging in continual improvement wherever we can.
Chair Loon.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I guess I'm just wondering, Assistant Commissioner, is there a mechanism if a business or a taxpayer wanted to sort of complain anonymously about a process? Is that possible so that their identity is actually protected?
Assistant Commissioner Starr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if folks receive our survey, I believe they can respond to that survey anonymously. I will admit it is harder to receive anonymous feedback because it makes it difficult for us to follow up and figure out exactly what happened and pinpoint whatever error on our part there might be and make a change. But yes, people are welcome to send us feedback anonymously if that's how they feel more comfortable.
Chair Loon.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Assistant Commissioner Starr? Excuse me. We'll go then to Mr. Cummings. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? Okay. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and members, to the bill, I'll divide my testimony into each section. There seems to be four distinct areas within this bill, so let me start with Section 1, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings.
Section 1 requires that by January 1st of 2017, that is department establish a private letter ruling program. The program would allow taxpayers to submit a description of facts regarding a particular transaction or structure and request that the department issue a binding determination on the Minnesota tax treatment of that transaction or structure. If that ruling is issued within 90 days, the department may charge up to $1,000. These rulings would provide guidance only to the specific taxpayer who requested the information and could not be used to have a precedential effect. We want to ensure that the department's published guidance is accessible and works well for all Minnesotans, Mr. Chair, not just those who are able to hire professionals to submit requests on their behalf. Serving a few individuals or entities who can afford the expense and time to prepare and submit such a ruling request would take time away from making available educational resources that are broadly applicable to all taxpayers. For instance, taxpayers have been asking for guidance on tax laws based on how they operate their business, rather than how statutes are numbered or how topics are easily grouped together by the department. We heard our customers and developed industry guides to help businesses find a one-stop shop for their sales tax collection needs. And I have some here, Mr. Chair, and they're on our website. For instance, we have industry guides for barbershops, salons, digital products, legal services, to name a few. Information broadly applicable, and we have heard from businesses, Mr. Chair, and they are appreciative. These guides provide easy access to information for all businesses in a given industry, many of whom are small businesses and meeting their statutory obligations. We also provide fact sheets, revenue notices, other information on our website that taxpayers find helpful that Ms. Starr went over just a few moments ago. Private letter rulings, in contrast, deal with narrow subjects applicable for only one taxpayer. I have a few examples here of private letter rulings from Illinois and California. These rulings reflect the types of requests that we would expect in Minnesota if we established a letter ruling. We have one from Illinois, specifically response to a large oil company requesting an apportionment variance. The rulings, there's also some from California that deal with other apportionment issues. These rulings focus the use of scarce state resources by a narrow class of sophisticated taxpayers. Well-resourced taxpayers utilizing complex structures and tax planning receive very narrow and tailored guidance from the state, and as a result, the agency has less time, money, and people to dedicate to advising the general public as a whole. These rulings would be expensive and resource-intensive to issue. Additionally, the process of making a request would be costly for the taxpayer. Requests for these rulings would almost always require the taxpayer to obtain the assistance of an attorney or other tax professional to prepare. They would also be costly for the department. In most cases, the $1,000 fee would not cover the actual cost to issue a ruling. In 1990, pursuant to a legislative mandate, DOR undertook a study consulting with the Bar Association and accounting professionals to determine whether it would be advisable to issue private letter rulings. The consensus at the time is that the department should allocate its resources to issues of broad applicability rather than to a specific taxpayer request for an analysis of the law as it relates, as applies to a particular set of circumstances in order to benefit the greatest number of taxpayers. So let me tell you about where we're at, Mr. Chair, and what it could mean under this bill. Today, we offer free education and information that are widely accessible in multiple formats. We have a robust website with broadly applicable fact sheets, industry guides, and videos. We respond to email questions within days, provide information, answer questions by phone. Ms. Starr went over, and free training all around the state. Under this bill, it could replace free informal Q&A options with the costly, slower process. Customers would pay up to $1,000 and wait up to 90 days. It would divert staff and resources from free education, Q&A, and outreach to meet demands for new letter ruling requirements. And it would increase the potential for confusion by posting or sending situation-specific information to wider audiences where it may apply, where it may not apply. Mr. Chair, let me move on to Section 2.
So it would be fair to say, Mr. Cummings, on Section 1, the department has some concerns?
Mr. Chair, we're happy to be a resource.
Thank you. Section 2, please.
Mr. Chair, Section 2 limits the department's ability to conduct compliance activities when information regarding the taxpayer's information was disclosed and approved in writing by the department, and the underlying Minnesota law was not materially changed. One of the questions we asked the author is what specific instances in which this has occurred. We want to know these instances. As Ms. Starr talked about, if we're seeing these instances, we do want to know about them. The department responds to every request that comes in, and our statutes already state that penalties must be abated if the taxpayer has received erroneous written advice from the department, and that's under Minnesota Statutes 270C.34. We always try to reach taxpayers furthest from compliance. Sometimes taxpayers may be further from compliance in some parts of the tax code and not others. The department routinely does single issue audits in various tax types. This would force the agency to do in-depth audits, and every time, to ensure every issue is documented and assessed. The department would also have to assess for all issues of noncompliance in every audit to protect the ability to audit, assess errors, and collect the appropriate amount of revenue under the statute in future years. This proposal will prevent the department from using audits to educate taxpayers, as we do now. DOR may have decided not to assess the taxpayer for various reasons, even though it could have or may have decided to settle without assigning dollars to specific items. DOR would have no reason to change this position, given DOR has supplied the proper law or position to the taxpayer previously. We could see two similarly situated taxpayers, Mr. Chair, one who is paying the tax, another down the street who is not paying the tax, and under this, we could see those two similarly situated taxpayers in the future have two different tax obligations. An issue of question that could be once a minor processing correction is made on a return and no other items are addressed, would this apply to prevent any tax from being assessed on a subsequent audit? Setting strict restrictions on the commissioner's authority to issue an assessment only because a particular issue is not assessed in a previous audit will limit the department's ability to enforce the tax code and collect the revenue stream that comes in from the tax code. This provision will likely lead to administrative disputes and litigation where taxpayers may attempt to use a provision as a shield even in scenarios where factual circumstances may have changed since the prior audit. This will lead to an uneven enforcement of the tax code when an issue is not identified in an audit of one taxpayer, then that taxpayer will receive better tax treatment than a similarly situated taxpayer. To be clear, Mr. Chair, Section 2 would mean that this is what we think it could mean for our customers. Today, Mr. Chair, revenue tries to limit the scope of audits to focus and assess on issues furthest from compliance. We educate businesses rather than assess on smaller issues found in the audit, limit the number of auditors and the time spent at the business location. Whenever possible, we limit the volume of documents requested. And we also use electronic file sharing to make it faster and easier to share records and help limit the time spent at the business. Under this bill, Mr. Chair, we would focus on all potential issues in the audit and review 100% of relevant records every time, address all issues of noncompliance, no matter how small, on the tax order. There may be more than one auditor for all audits, with more time spent at the business. There would be longer audits with higher impact on businesses' day-to-day operations, and there would be longer, more time-consuming documents requests. These were the longer sections, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to briefly go through sections 3 and 4.
Just real quick, Mr. Cummings, on Section 2, I certainly can see where Representative Rosenthal is coming from on this, because it's almost like a business is put in double jeopardy. I mean, not really, but it kind of feels like that, because you've gone through an audit, you got a clean bill of health, let's go, and all of a sudden you get audited down the road, and oh, by the way, from your last audit, which you passed with flying colors, now there's something wrong. And I think Representative Rosenthal has some very, very good points in Section 2. So maybe, I mean, the discussion, I think we should talk further on that point, because I've had that where somebody says, well, I was audited, everything's fine, or they found a few corrections, made them, they get audited a couple of years later, and boom, the hammer comes down on a previous audit where we thought we were okay. And so we can talk about that later, but on Section 2, let's go section by section. Section 2, any questions for members on Section 2? Okay, thank you. Mr. Cummings, 3 and 4?
Mr. Chair, and we would welcome that conversation. Mr. Chair, in Section 3 of the bill, this provision would give the Commissioner complete discretion to impose, not impose, or abate civil tax penalties in 289A.60 or other law or additional tax charges under 289A. This would be difficult to implement on a fair and consistent basis and would likely generate litigation. This would give sweeping level of discretion to the Department regarding penalty imposition with no applicable standards. Current standards allow taxpayers to know that they are being treated fairly, just like any other taxpayer in the state. Again, Mr. Chair, this section could perpetuate a myth that a well-connected taxpayer can get their penalties abated. The commissioner already has the authority to abate late pay and late file penalties for reasonable cause under 270C.34. This bill could result in increased noncompliance by taxpayers by allowing them to argue that the commissioner is not required to impose, or in the alternative, must abate penalties for noncompliance, with which an auditor, appeals officer, the tax court may agree with. This would result in new litigation over whether the commissioner has the right in circumstances to impose the penalty, leaving it to a court to interpret the complexities of statutes. All of our customers, Mr. Chair, deserve to know that they will be treated fairly under the law. There should be consistent standards for all taxpayers when possible, and that standard should be done with policymakers, Mr. Chair. Finally, Mr. Chair, on to Section 4. Section 4 prohibits the assessment of the failure to pay penalty when the total penalty amount is less than $150. This section completely eliminates the cost recovery, incentivizing compliance with the tax laws, and punitive effects of penalties under $150. This raises concerns about how the department would administer the prohibition on imposing total penalties under that amount. It would also create a lot of ambiguity and complexity in the penalty process. Current law requires the commissioner to impose a penalty of 4 to 15% depending on the tax type. When a taxpayer fails to pay their tax penalty on time, no matter how small the penalty may be once the applicable penalty percentage is applied to the unpaid amount. Some late payment penalties are imposed on a graduated basis. So it's unclear whether only the first 150 would not be imposed. What if the penalty starts out under 150, but over the course of time exceeds 150? How would that be handled under the new language? If a penalty on a return adds up to 150 or less, it would not be assessed. This would have a bigger impact than just on returns. Penalties are used as a way to assure that businesses are not intentionally ignoring due dates. It ensures that taxpayers are treated fairly. Under this law, taxpayers who file and pay on time, especially in sales tax, would be treated the same as those who consistently file and pay late. By not assessing penalties on late returns, we would also need to stop assessing the repeat delinquency penalty in the area of sales tax. This penalty is used to reinforce the due dates that need to be followed. Mr. Chair, as for the bill in total, this would be a significant cost to the agency, as we would have to hire many more staff, Mr. Chair. We are preparing a fiscal note for the bill and expect it to have a significant cost. We will provide it as soon as we can, but we want to ensure the committee knows it will include the cost for an additional unit for the private letter rulings, the auditors to ensure we are enforcing the tax code fairly and collecting the revenue state for the state. Mr. Chair, we are committed to ensuring we administer the tax code that all taxpayers will be treated fairly under the law, not just the wealthy. In particular, the private letter ruling has the effect of creating a tax code for those who can afford professional services to submit these requests. The department's goal is to serve all taxpayers with the information and education they need, as well as audit those who are furthest from compliance with our laws. This bill moves us farther away from that goal. If this bill continues through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal, and staff, and we thank you for the opportunity to be a resource.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. And when I said, please be prepared for today's meeting, I was just kidding. That was very good, very thorough. House File 2876 is amended. I happen to think I like the Rosenthal bill, but I know the department has concerns. I'm sure we're actually quite close. Okay. With that being said, questions from members of the committee. Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Ms. Starr. Ms. Starr, are the casinos subject to audit on sales and use based on our tax agreement with them?
Assistant Commissioner Starr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I got to tell you that's a complicated area of law, and I would need help. I'm sorry. Can we get back to you on it?
Or do we, Mr. Michael or Ms. Manzi? You want to... We'll just let her go? Okay.
She'll answer me.
Ms. Starr, you'll get back to Chair Erickson.
Yes. Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative, I will.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Cummings? Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Cummings, for your resourcefulness. And so I heard in your testimony, Mr. Cummings, you know, discussions about, you know, rich and poor and kind of the whole class dividing thing here, which is, you know, I guess somewhat expected sometimes from this administration. But isn't it, I mean, the rich people, and I'm not rich, and you, Mr. Chair, are maybe a little different, though, but the rich people are paying all the bulk of the taxes in this state and have the most... the most exposure to your agency and to, I mean, so Mr. Cummings, if you, I mean, wouldn't it, doesn't it make sense that those are the people that would need this type of help that the author is bringing forward? I mean, how many working family credit tax situations do you actually audit?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wanted to say, as it relates to this bill, I think it is a question of priorities, Mr. Chair. And as we're trying to ensure that we are trying to live up to our vision that all taxpayers report, receive, and pay the right amount, no more, no less, we have to think about how do we prioritize the use of resources in order to make that happen. So I think that there might be some instances in which some people are saying, and Representative Drazkowski, to your point, I don't think that that necessarily is a bad thing to have specialized advice to certain taxpayers. That is not an absolute right or wrong thing, right? But in terms of trying to prioritize, how do we ensure that with the millions of taxpayers who are trying to voluntarily comply with our tax laws, how do we ensure that we are reaching the most possible so that they can voluntarily comply and pay? And I think that's why we asked Ms. Starr to come, is to really say we're focusing on outreach, we're focusing on education, we're focusing on coaching, because we think that that is the best way in which we can reach the broadest number of taxpayers. Now, in terms of, you also asked a question about the working family credit, and we have a number of refundable credits. And I can have someone come and talk to you about the extent of auditing that we do in that area. Mr. Chair, we don't have certain types of taxpayers who are audited and who are not audited, as we like to talk about. And while we can't talk specifically, we look at those furthest from compliance. So if they are furthest from compliance, whether or not they get the working family credit or whether or not they pay a different amount, those are the people that we're trying to get to. But I can work with you offline, Representative Drazkowski, about the second part of that question.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Cummings, I guess I'm not getting at, I mean, it's a complicated discussion, but... you know, the people who have the most money at stake here and the highest amount of tax liability are the ones that are going to have the most complex tax form situations and exposure to audit, I would suspect. Let me ask another question. How many 1040 EZs, or whatever our Minnesota equivalent is, do we have? What's our Minnesota one called?
Mr. Cummings?
M1, Mr. Chair.
How many M1s do we audit?
Mr. Gostkowski.
Mr. Cummings? In terms of the number of audits of M1s, I would have to get back to you. And I can, Chair Drazkowski. I know that we have about 2.9 million returns that come in every year.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to that, Mr. Cummings, on both of those questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Any other questions? Mr. Cummings, can you help us with 1095-A's?
Mr. Cummings? We're happy to be a resource to this committee, and as it relates to providing any feedback to the committee about anything that impacts the Department of Revenue, we'd be more than happy to partner with you, Mr. Chair.
And just so members and folks realize, it's not the department that's having issues here, and I do appreciate your work. So with that, and no other questions, thank you, Mr. Cummings. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Starr. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. I will move that House File 2076 as amended be later for possible inclusion in an omnibus
tax Chair.
Bill. Thank you. Item next, we're fortunate today to have Representative Franz in with us, House File 2272. Members, we should have, are there any amendments here?
Oh,
okay. There should be members. There should be three amendments. I have two. There's one in here. Okay. And just to get the bill in the shape you author, like, are these all author amendments?
I think she's off.
Yeah, you want to make two, and then we'll address that after. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
No. Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, we just have an A1 in the packet.
Right, you should. Have they been passed off?
No, nope. We just have one.
Okay, we won't take action on any of the amendments until we have them all in front of all members. We do have the A1 amendment.
And we can withdraw that.
Chair Dabney.
I just made life easier.
The A1 was yours?
Yes, and that can be withdrawn.
Chair Dabney removes the A1 amendment.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair Dabney. We now have A2 and A3. We'll just hold off on these for a second until members have everything. Representative Franzen, I will move House File 2272. If you could please describe the bill, Representative Franzen. As if it had the amendments you refer on it, please present your bill to the committee.
Yes, thank you. Chair Davids and committee members, I have Tammy, which I can never pronounce her last name correctly, from the great city of Alexandria. You know, the one easy to get to and hard to leave. And so we here have in front of us a farm winery tax credit. And since taxes is not my forte, I'm going to allow my constituent to present the bill for you.
Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Okay. My name is Tammy Bredesen, and I represent both Carlos Creek Winery in Alexandria, Minnesota, and the Farm Winery Association. Which
and how, can you please spell your last name?
Certainly. B as in boy, R, E, D like David, E, S-O-N.
Oh, just like it sounds. Okay.
Just great. Like it sounds.
Just like it sounds.
Well, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity here to testify, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This bill was first introduced in 2014, so this is our third go-around to get this excise tax credit established. Some history on it is, we're asking for a small producer excise tax credit. This small producer excise tax credit is in existence for brewers and for distillers. It also exists on the federal level. There have long time been small producer credits for excise tax at the federal level. For some reason, there's not one for Minnesota wineries, and we would like to right that wrong with this bill. So we are asking for small producer credits. Some of the amendments, if you read through them, have to do with making sure that our final language is inclusive not only of all Minnesota wineries But to be in compliance with the commerce law, we need to make sure that we include non-Minnesota wineries as well. We'd like this to read not as a farm winery bill, but as a small winery bill, asking for the amounts of the excise tax credit as outlined in the bill there. And everywhere, if and I'm not certain which version you are all looking at, but if you have a version that says farm, we would request that the farm word be stricken and small be put in its place, with a definition at the end that for the purposes of this subdivision, a small winery would be defined as one producing 75,000 gallons annually or less. And that would make it inclusive, in-state, out-of-state. It mirrors the type of language and the amount of credit that we see with the brewers and the distillers in the state of Minnesota. There is a cap for production, which defines a small producer for both the distillers and the brewers. And then there's a maximum allowed credit annually. Any questions?
Any questions for Ms. Bredesen from members? Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if, I know Mr. Clayman is still getting ready, but does this, if we were to make this change to small, although I see an amendment here for something else, how does that conflict with what the Ag Department says about the winery industry and its size?
Mr. Clayman?
Do we know if there's going to be a conflict there?
I can address that.
Okay.
Okay, Ms. Bredesen?
Okay, thank you. I believe what you're talking about is the Department of Ag does not currently license wineries,
no.
But they are called farm wineries, which does give that connection back to ag.
Yes.
There is a distinction for farm wineries as well as small wineries in the state of Minnesota that we are required to use a majority of our fruit that is grown in the state. 51% is the rule. Possibly you've heard the 51% rule. So we are governed by that, whether we are farm wineries or small wineries in the state. Obviously, the wineries that exist outside of the state would not have this type of restriction, nor do I believe that we can make that restriction required of out-of-state wineries and still be in compliance with the Commerce Clause. So the farm wineries currently have a limit on production of 75,000 gallons. So this would mirror that 75,000 gallon limit.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think Mr. Clayman and I have been talking here, and I think we've concluded that in order to satisfy the Commerce Clause, what we need to do is to work on which we won't do for the committee now, but can do later on, is a different amendment that would essentially provide a use tax exemption for out-of-state. This is the situation, as I understand it, is that farm wineries are licensed and pay tax directly on the product that they produce and sell on the premises.
Yes.
And what we would want to do is to give, and essentially what the original bill does is to give them an exemption up to the first 75,000 gallons or a credit against the tax that they would pay. And what we'd want to do is to extend similar treatment to out-of-state wineries for the essentially the product that they sell on the premises, not through distributors where the exemption doesn't apply, so that would eliminate the complication of trying to extend this credit to some wine that's sold through distributors, because essentially this is sort of a direct pay exemption. Where that tax in theory would come in is if someone goes to an out-of-state winery that meets the same sort of requirements that apply to a Minnesota farm winery, buys wine, and then brings it back into Minnesota. In theory, there's a use tax obligation that applies. And in that circumstance, to treat the out-of-state wineries the same way we treat the Minnesota wineries, what we'd want to do is to give a credit to the consumer against the use tax that applies, not if they're selling it through distributors or paying it otherwise. So that's going to take a little bit more more work.
Chair
Erickson. Can I respond to that?
Ms. Bredesen?
What we are looking for here is an excise tax credit, not a sales or a use tax credit. And so right now, if you ship wine into the state of Minnesota, it is not subject to excise tax at all. So an out-of-state winery that wants to ship wine into the state of Minnesota is not subject, that wine is not subject to excise tax, nor is it subject to sales tax. So out-of-state wineries, typically that are less than 75,000 gallons, are not going to be distributing wine through the three-tier system. They're simply too small. However, if they do, that credit should follow them into distribution. It certainly does with the brewers, and it does with the distillers. Right. So Shell's Brewery, which is the largest brewing company in the state of Minnesota, would receive the maximum credit under the brewing tax credit of $115,000 each and every year, because their production would max out that credit. Now, none of Shell's is sold at Shell's. It is all sold through distributors. So we are only looking for equal treatment. Whether our wine is sold through a distributor, whether our wine is sold out the door of our farm winery, whether we ship it directly to a consumer, we would like excise tax credit on that production, the same as brewers and distillers receive. And all of those means of sales are available to those other distributors. And at the federal level, no distinction is made on type of sale. So I guess I'm not understanding the use tax and adding we would not be in favor of adding a use tax amendment to this. We simply clearly want the excise tax credit that the brewers and the distillers receive.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, there under the excise tax, there is, if you purchase wine, beer, distilled spirits outside Minnesota and import it into Minnesota as a consumer, a use tax that's complement to the excise tax applies. And that is the tax that I was saying, that if we're going to give equivalent give equivalent treatment to out-of-state wineries, that you would need to extend it to. The way this bill is drafted, it only applies to the farm winery tax, their direct pay excise tax, not when they're selling through distributors. If you want to give them a credit that's equivalent to what the beer, that essentially the beer small brewery credit, this would have to be redrafted so that it would extend generally. If that's what the proponents, you know, want, it takes a somewhat different bill than what's here.
Excise tax is, excuse me, can I respond to that? Excise tax is paid on all of our production, whether we sell it to a liquor store or it isn't direct pay on what we sell at the winery. I believe that the use tax that you're talking about does require a person who purchases wine, beer, spirits, and has them in their possession, and they know that the excise tax was not paid, then the excise tax is owed. So if you go to Wisconsin and you buy wine and you bring that back to the state of Minnesota, the Wisconsin winery will have paid excise tax to the state of Wisconsin on that, and that qualifies you to not have to pay excise tax. If somehow you got into your possession wine that where no excise tax was paid, then excise tax is owed on that as a use tax, as you spoke of. But if the excise tax was paid either to another state or to the state of Minnesota, then it's not owed again.
Chair Erickson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just concerned that language does matter, and the words we choose to use in statute shouldn't become confusing when those who, for example, own farm wineries have to refer to agricultural laws. Because I found this out in education very quickly, that we can really confuse either the consumer or the student or the school district or whoever it might be when we sometimes change our verbiage in with good intention, but in the long run it may confuse. So just a point of information.
Chair Dabney?
Mr. Chair, I think at this point, I think the testifier has made it clear that if you're selling a bottle out the door, you're paying the excise tax.
Correct.
Ms. Bredesen?
And that was my question, Mr. Chair, because I've got some small producers in the room who are looking to be treated equally to the farm wineries.
Okay. Other questions for members on this House file? Representative Franzen, do we want to hold off a bit before we do any amendments to work with Mr. Michael to get some language the way it should be here?
I'm good to go.
What?
Representative Franzen, or Chair Dabney?
I have the A3 amendment with an oral amendment that I worked out just before committee, hence the oral amendment, with Ms. Bredesen and Representative Franzen. And I don't know how the author wishes to proceed at this time or the chair.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and maybe get it closer to where the author wants it. I'll move the A2 amendment.
I don't.
Representative Franzen?
No, we're not going to move the A2.
Like I said, I'm going to put that on the pile. Okay, now I'll move the A3 amendment. Representative Dabney moves something.
I've got an oral amendment.
Please state your oral amendment.
On page 1, line 6. Delete or in out of state, leave winery just the way it is, and delete the produces not.
So members, the Dabney oral amendment would delete on line 1.6 or an out of state winery, leave the word winery, delete that produces not. So that would read insert winery more than.
And then that was the deletion and then the insertion, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
On that same line and page and line, a qualifying and then winery for the purposes of this subdivision produces not. And I'll let you work on that and then I can explain the amendment. To the amendment.
Mr. Michael, do you want to repeat that? On line 1.6. Or Mr. Clayman, I'm sorry. Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair, so the language for the amendment as I have it here would be page 1, line 6, delete or an out-of-state winery, delete that produces not. Just to clarify that, so delete or an out-of-state and insert a qualifying, leave winery as it is. Also, page 1, line 6, delete that produces not and insert for purposes of this subdivision produces not. Or, Mr. Chair?
Clear as can be.
Mr. Clayman?
To clean that up a little bit,
we just read it. It needs cleaning.
Page 1, line 6, delete an out of state and insert a qualifying. Also, page 1, line 6, delete that and insert for purposes of this subdivision.
That's easier.
Oh. Very good. Do members understand what we're doing here?
Yes.
Chair Dabney?
I understand.
Okay. As long as Chair Dabney understands.
An English teacher approved, so.
Yeah. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails on the oral amendment. Now we have the A3 amendment as amended. Questions? Representative Franzen. Or Ms. Bredesen.
The end part of that, I'm not certain if it was stricken or not, and I'm sorry I didn't follow all that, but after 75,000 gallons of table, we're on line 1.7, was sparkling fortified wine. Table sparkling and
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair, no, that was not stricken.
No,
or that, deleted. Excuse
me. That needs to be stricken. It needs to only say wine, and the wine includes several categories, including cider. And I believe we would be unconstitutional if we did not include cider. So you either have to add cider or just simply say wine.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dabney.
We wouldn't want to be unconstitutional, would we?
Well, who says we are? I always say we're not unconstitutional until somebody tells us we are.
I guess, but the testifier is indicating that we might be. So I would be...
Can you help us out here?
Yeah.
Please. So we're deleting everything, then?
I would be willing to move on page 1, line 7, delete table, comma, sparkling, comma, or fortified.
Okay, we have a Dabney amendment before us. Any questions or further discussion? Mr. Klayman, you have the amendment? On page 1.7, also delete table, comma, sparkling, comma, or fortified. What is a fortified wine?
Like port.
Sports drink?
Port. Port.
Fortified.
Yeah, port. Right, fortified.
Port,
what
port
is
not
that?
Sport.
It would be port wine, sherry wine, any wine where high-proof spirits have been added to a fermented wine.
Like it's healthier for you?
No, it's actually,
fortified.
I mean cherries. Are
fortified with vitamins.
Okay.
Yeah. Fortified
not
with
the health
high
like
test.
This. Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, the next portion of the oral amendment would be page 1, line 7, delete table, sparkling, or fortified.
And the comments.
Chair Dabney, that's okay.
That's my amendment, Mr.
We have a Dabney amendment. I think we understand. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the A3 amended as amended. Any further discussion on A3?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Just so members understand, what this does, and with the assistance of the farm winery folks, is apply this same statute to all the wineries in the state with wine as defined by the federal government, which includes things that I don't think of as wine, but they do. So it's supporting all of our small wineries. Thank you.
Chair Dabney, you represent Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And whereas I would never prescribe to tell the chair anything at this point, I do feel like we are kind of a little bit confused as to where this bill is and where the author is entitled and wanting to go, and whether or not even this amendment is what the author wants as well. Is it appropriate for us to think about at least tabling this until we have some clear vision on what's going on?
Your point, Representative Petersburg, very well taken. I think that will kind of have the same effect because it'll be laid over possible conclusions.
Thank you.
And I would encourage all sides to work together to try and figure this part out. So
very, very wise, Mr.
Kind of the same. We'll have the same effect. But very good point. Point well taken. Okay, so we now have the E3 amendment as amended. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 2272 as amended. Any further questions? Did the gentleman wish to testify? Or?
No, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, with that, I will move House File 2272 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, Ms. Bredesen. Thank you, Representative Franzen. We've got a little work to do, but that's what we do. Okay. Representative Johnson, I believe. Any amendment? I want to try some of that fortified stuff. Mm-hmm. Oh, really? How would he know?
I think.
Okay, with that, Chair Johnson, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2505 so that it's before the committee. If you could please present your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. House File 2505. The purpose of this bill is to extend a current tax credit to more veterans, in particular low-income and disabled veterans. Currently, Minnesota provides an income tax credit up to $750 to veterans who have served at least 20 years or have a service-connected disability of 100%. And current law phases out this credit at a rate of 10% when adjusted gross income equals $30,000 with no credit for incomes of $37,500 or higher. And this tax credit was enacted in 2008. What this bill does is increases the income level at which credit phase-out begins from $30,000 to $50,000 with no credit allowed for incomes of $57,500 or higher. And then secondly, it also expands the eligibility by extending the credit to all disabled veterans who have a compensable service-connected disability. Mr. Chair, a preliminary revenue note was completed. However, at this point, we don't have a fiscal impact amount for expanding eligibility criteria, but that information should be available in a week or two.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. You have someone that wishes to testify on behalf of the bill?
Yes. That is correct, sir.
Is there anyone that wishes to, other, anyone else wish to testify on behalf of the bill or with concerns? Okay, so we've got two people. Okay, so please present your testimony, and then we'll go to other folks who would like to testify, and then we'll go to members' questions.
Thank you, Chair. Please state
your name and who represents the record, please, sir.
Sure. Tom Diamond, DFL Veterans Caucus. Thank you, Chair, committee members.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. House File 2505 would benefit more veterans than any other bill that has been proposed. The tax break also helps those with the greatest needs. Veterans housing, care, service officers, veterans preference, veterans cemeteries are vital services, and funding those is a priority. When there are additional funds that may be available to help veterans individually, we'd like to see those funds go to all veterans. Realizing there's limits on funds, if you can't fund it for all veterans, we would like to see that their focus be on those veterans who have the greatest financial needs and disabled veterans. What House File 2505 does, of the 369,000 Minnesota veterans, this would provide the eligibility for all disabled veterans within the cap. So all disabled veterans would be eligible for it. And that's the existing program, which is only limited to 100% disabled right now. It also expands the gross income, as was pointed out. It moves it from $30,000 to $50,000 with the taper off to $57,500, which benefits both the disabled and retired veterans, those receiving retired pay. Our disabled veterans deserve all the help they can get, including disabled veterans, is the morally right thing to do. Of the veterans, there are 18,368 who receive retired pay. There are 88,000 disabled veterans in Minnesota. Just to give you a comparison of 2505 and House File 848, and how I believe that 2505 will expand the benefits to those who have the greatest needs and expand the overall benefits to a greater number of veterans. 2505, veterans benefits is provided to more veterans than any other legislation. It includes all disabled veterans who are within the income cap. 848 excludes most veterans but grants full veterans benefits to non-veterans, which is just fine, but when many of the vast majority of veterans are prevented from having, eliminated from it, we think that the priority should first be to the veterans. For example, 848 provides a full benefit to spouses of veterans, but excludes 350,000 of the 369,000 from receiving any benefit at all as a veteran. 2505 raises the retains the income cap, so more veterans with limited income receive a benefit. But there, in 848, there is no income limit to receive the tax break. 848 is not limited to retirement pay. It's all incomes are available for a benefit, while again, there are no benefits for the vast majority of veterans. In 2505, and with that, I should point out that in 848, the annual retired pay, the average annual retired pay is $1,828 in the state of Minnesota. 848 provides a $40,000 deductible for married filing joint, vastly over what the average retirement benefit is. House File 2505 provides all veterans receive the same benefit. So veterans equally treated across the board. A married couple, age 65 or greater, filing jointly using standard exemptions and standard deduction, are eligible for who are eligible for the current $750 credit, would pay no taxes on a gross income of $37,100. So $37,000, you would pay no taxes. 848 provides the greatest benefits to those who least need it. With the proposed changes, the same couple, using an example, with a gross income of $50,000, would, instead of receiving a $750 benefit, would receive a $1,436 benefit. Those with a gross income of $75,000 would see a $2,398 benefit. And those with $100,000 would receive a $2,820 benefit. The point is that this is nearly four times the benefit that 100% disabled or lower income veteran would receive. So the question really, I believe, is should we give large financial benefits to those who least need it, or expand the eligibility to those who most need it? I encourage your support of 2505 so we can help veterans who have the greatest financial need and disabled veterans. 2505 serves the most veterans. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Diamond? And members, just so you know, I'm a bit partial to House File 848. With that being said, is there anyone else wishing to testify on behalf of this bill? Now, members, it's my intention to lay over House File 2314 for tomorrow, out of respect for hopefully members can get a sandwich before floor session. So we do need to get over to the floor. So next testifier, please.
If I could, Mr. Chair.
You can't. You don't like 848. No.
No, what I did last
your testimony.
If my testimony was not against 848, my intent is to point out that if you have limited resources, how do you put those resources to the most good, to the greatest need? And that hopefully we can take a look at how we can have a break that provides the greatest benefit to the most veterans and to the those with the greatest need. And the other piece of that is, as you know, there has not the companion bills in the Senate have not even got a hearing, and that possibly by broadening out to greater number of veterans and providing an across the board benefit, possibly we can broaden the support for any legislation like this, and we can get something passed. Thank you.
Okay, if the next gentleman could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is John Wexler. I'm from Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, and I'm with the DFL Veterans Caucus. I just want to underscore what Tom Diamond, who was just before me, said, that we're looking for a broader support of the veterans that have served us. Many of us have put our lives on the line. And I just think that we think that a broader that support that serves everybody instead of a limited number of people. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you please spell your last name for the record, please?
Wexler.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Wexler. Any questions for Mr. Wexler? Okay, the next gentleman, if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm a combat disabled Vietnam veteran and the vice chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council and the co-chairman of the Military Action Group.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
We appreciate Representative Johnson's coming up with this. Unfortunately, we had no idea that it was coming on board. We are kind of a clearinghouse for all bills that go through, and we appreciate being able to discuss this. We have no problem with the part of the program that is increasing the amount from $30,000 to $50,000, because our whole operation is to make Minnesota more veteran-friendly and more business-friendly, and to bring in these second retired, not retired, just their second income veterans coming back after 20 years of service in the United States military. The way that we need to get them here is to make it enticement to get them to come back, and that's where we're talking about the previous bill that we have on the books here waiting. This one would be an adjunct to that if, in fact, we didn't have the additional part on it. There are 18,300 retirees in the state of Minnesota. Less than 7,000 of them use this particular one to get $750. The impact with the revenue department, which impacts all the other bills that we have coming up, would be significant in the fact that it would deter those gentlemen and ladies from getting the larger portion of it. Right now, $750 is important, but if you have a 10% disability, you get $150 a month from the VA. If you get your 100%, or you if you have one person, you get $3,070 a month, and that money is all tax free. Any veteran who's currently getting any disability payments from the VA is tax free. The way that we can best introduce this into is to maybe change the numbers a little bit on the percentages, because again, it's going to affect, if all these people are getting that amount, it's going to directly affect any other bill that we have in the business. So we'd like to work with Representative Johnson to come up with an equitable program that would be befitting of both processes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kaiser. Any questions for Mr. Kaiser? Okay, the next gentleman. Is there anyone else in the audience who testified for or against this bill, or with concern? Not against, with concerns. Please state your name for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joseph Chera, C-H-E-R-R-A. I'm from Brooklyn Park.
Welcome to committee, sir.
When I returned from serving in Vietnam, I was told to have my dental work taken care of within a year. After that, I was alone. When we sent troops off to the Persian Gulf, Afghanistan, and Iraq, it was with great fanfare. When they returned home, it was also met with ceremony and celebration. I thought things had finally improved for our veterans. After reading Mr. Diamond's presentation, I'm finding out that not much has changed in the last 50 years. Sure, we say thank you for your service, but do we really mean it? Do we want to be saying to our veterans, these people are more important to you, their service was more valuable than yours, and their spouses are more important to you? They don't need to hear that. They were told that every day that they served. Those people lived in different housing, dined in different mess halls, and even worked in different offices. Those people, enlisted personnel as well as officers, made a career choice. They chose to stay in the Army, Air Force, Marines, and Navy for 20 to 30 years, and are now receiving their rewards. The lower-ranking enlisted personnel faced a career change after leaving the armed forces. The civilian world had changed and their jobs had disappeared. Too many are unemployed, too many are homeless, too many are suffering from the injuries and effects of multiple deployments, and we're not there for them. Are we saying thank you for your service, but it wasn't as important as the service as others was? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any questions for Mr. Chera or members? Anyone else in the audience would like to wish to testify? Okay, with that, Chair Johnson, I will move House File 2505. I'll be later for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Johnson, and for everyone that testified. Anything else from committee members for the good of the order? With that, we will start tomorrow. We will add House File, just for the record, House File 2314 to the agenda tomorrow. With that, good government all the time. We're adjourned.